This episode of The Hammer is brought to you by All Weather Windows. All Weather Windows is Canada's leading manufacturer of high-performance, energy-efficient windows, doors, and glass. With their expert market knowledge, All Weather Windows offers a complete range of products tailored to suit your specific regional needs, ensuring each one meets or exceeds the latest local and national building codes and stringent energy efficiency standards. Not only that, All Weather Windows' entire product catalog is NAFS and NFRC certified, promising unmatched value and comfort for your customers. Let All Weather Windows be your first choice for all your door and window needs. Visit their website, allweatherwindows.com, to learn more.
Welcome to The Hammer, where we hit the nail on the head with insights from the world of Canadian renovation and custom home contracting. Now here's your host, the editor of Canadian Contractor Magazine, Patrick Flannery.
Hey, everybody, and welcome back to The Hammer. It's Pat Flannery coming at you here, editor of Canadian Contractor Magazine, once again, editor of Canadian Contractor Magazine. What's happening it's worded strangely, but the 2020 National Building Code, of course, which is the model code that all the provinces base their codes on. The 2020 National Building Code is coming up to its five-year update in 2025. The proposed changes are out there for public review, and I decided that I'm going to do sort of a series of these podcasts talking about the changes that are coming up with a focus on various sectors of the code that are of interest. And what I wanted to start off with was the changes on the fenestration side, on the window and door side. It's something I know a little bit more about, so it was an appropriate place to start. And to help me out with this, actually to do all the work on this, is Terry Adamson. He is the Technical Director for Fenestration Canada, which is Canada's association, for those of you who don't know, for the window and door manufacturers and dealers, everybody who makes and sells fenestration in the country. Terry, welcome. Great to see you.
Patrick, thanks. This is a career dream of mine to get on The Hammer. I've listened to probably all of your sessions, and always great info, and really, really happy to be here and hopefully share a little bit of my understanding of what's going on at the code level.
Yeah, absolutely. Terry is really all the way up there on codes and standards, especially window and door codes and standards. He's been working on the committees and the education and everything for a long time. And nobody better really to explain to us what contractors, what we as home renovation custom home builders are going to need to know about how the NBC is going to make changes, make adjustments to how we put the fenestration in the buildings. But Terry, before we begin, quick background on yourself, what you're doing for Fenestration Canada, and how you got into this crazy thing.
How I got into this crazy thing? No kidding. It was the summer of 1985. And I was doing some very manual work as a young 25-year-old at the time, and a buddy of mine from school told me that the window company he was working at was looking for people. So I've never forgiven him. So yeah, this will be my 39th summer in the business. Started out with an aluminum residential window manufacturer in Langley, BC. Owned by Casey Kirkhoff. I worked for Casey pretty much my entire career through a couple of different companies. I'm the epitome of a ladder climber. I started working on the loading dock. I ended up as a shipping manager. And then I was shop foreman and then production manager. And then I moved into the office and I did purchasing and order entry, et cetera, et cetera. I worked my way through, and I was actually general manager with Westech Windows in Chilliwack for about 11 years, and then became their technical director, which really is my passion of the industry. I've always just loved diving into the details. So I did that for about 10 years up until 2020 or 2021, I guess. During that time, I certainly played in the association world. I was with Fenestration BC for about a dozen years, president of that group a couple of times. And then I really wanted to be on the national scene. So I started working with the folks at Fenestration Canada. I got onto their board and then served a year or year and a half of, as president there. Great time. I really enjoyed it. Great people, lots of good stuff. And then my life was in such a position that I was looking for a bit of a change. I was kind of done with that day-to-day manufacturing world. And the opportunity presented itself to join Fenestration Canada as an employee, as their technical director. So that was 3 years ago now, just about, in a few weeks. And I got to tell you, best move I ever made. I love every single day of it. Love working with all the all of our members and participating to help them figure out how to get through this crazy world of fenestration. So I enjoy it. I enjoy every minute of it.
That's fantastic. And we enjoy you and all of your, and all of your information. I want to encourage everyone listening to really go ahead and use Fenestration Canada as a resource. As an organization, they are very open and very willing to help non-members, anyone who has questions. Sure. Windows, doors, challenges, installation, product, anything you need help with on your on that side of the thing, fenestrationcanada.ca is the website. Numbers and contacts are there. They will assist you if you have questions and need to know more about your about the window and door side of your project. So I'll just leave that out there. And Terry, look out, because here come the phone calls. But
you know what? I want to reinforce that, though, because I do get calls from consumers, from builders, from building officials. And I recently worked on a situation with a realtor and a home purchaser that had questions about the products in that home. So, yeah, we're happy to assist anybody that is having challenges in the fenestration world, for sure.
Yeah, it is absolutely not a closed shop. So, so make those calls and make use of them. Let's get into it. They're still calling it the 2020 NBC, but what we're talking about is actually the 2025 NBC. Terry, tell us where they are in the update process right now, and I guess where people can find the information about it.
You bet. So I believe that this, if I'm not mistaken, this is the second public review of the changes that will be made or potentially be made to the National Building Code of 2020, which is just coming into play across the country. So this is the public review that runs from February 27th to April the 29th. It's open to anybody. Anyone that has interest can go and look at what these proposed changes are, what the logic is behind them, and they can actually comment to them if they have, details that they want to address. That change, I believe there will be one more late summer, early fall, and you can go to it, and it's got a bit of an address. It's CBHCC-CCHCC-CA/EN public review. You know what? Just search National Building Code public review and it'll take you to the site. It's surprisingly a relatively easy site to navigate. It sort of breaks up all of these proposed changes by subjects, fenestration, energy performance. It breaks up the National Building Code, the Fire Code, the National Energy Code, as well as the Plumbing Code. So it's really easy to get in there, have a look at things that are titled that will give you a good idea of what it's about. And then you can open it up. You can go and dive into it. There's a lot of info on all of these code change proposals. And I highly encourage you, if the building code impacts you, you should go and have a look and look at what these changes mean.
Yeah, I'll echo that they've done a lot of, they've done a lot of good work to make it a little better organized, a little easier to access. Yeah. It's less dense and confusing than it. Well, I mean, you know, back in the day, you'd have to send away for the paper copy and read the whole thing. I mean, this is even in the early days of the web, they were it was very opaque and hard to navigate and a lot of scrolling. And they seem to have seem to have addressed a lot of that. So we're ahead. Okay, in the interest of getting through all of this, because there's a lot, I've got to try to talk less. Let's start just looking at the notes that we took here, Terry. One of the first things we were going to talk about are changes to accessibility in buildings. What's going on there?
Yeah, there is an awful lot of activity going on with accessibility and adaptability. And those are two terms that you really need to wrap your head around because they're very different, even though a lot of the content obviously points to the same kinds of things. It's all about making buildings more usable for people that are challenged. But accessibility means exactly that, making changes to make the building more accessible for people that are challenged. Adaptability is building buildings that are easily adaptable to make them accessible. So even though the changes often are the same, the impact and how you deal with that item is different. For example, I'll give you a great example that I sit on a lot of these code groups right now. It's obviously part of my job. For 25 plus years, I was a code user. Everybody knows how frustrating that is. Become a code developer. It's really challenging. It can be really challenging. Anyway, back to the adaptability. For example, you're building a shower, tub shower in your house. One of the adaptability items is that you need to put blocking in behind the drywall around that shower so that at some point down the road, somebody can adapt that shower with handlebars, fall bars, things like that. I won't go into how long we talked about where blocking should be. It was a long time.
Wow.
But accessible and adaptable, they're two different things, even though they kind of talk about the same kind of stuff. A few of the changes, proposed changes that are happening right now that are of interest is Code Change 1880. And that is potentially going to open up all dwelling types to follow accessible design. I encourage everybody to look at this if you're a builder. What it means is that accessible design and adaptable design will likely fall on all building types, single family, row houses, large buildings, MERBs. So it's a good one to read to get a good understanding of how those changes will impact all building types. So that's Code Change 1880. Give it a look. The other one that we've had a lot of discussion on from the fenestration side is 1883. And this proposes that one entry opening has to have a clear width of 850 millimeters. So that got a lot of discussion because that means that you're looking at a 3-foot door, quote unquote, 3-foot, because that term is also confusing. A 3-foot door in the industry, for the most part, means a 35 3/4-inch slab. Getting 850 millimeter opening is very, very close. And that can be impacted by, you know, very, very small tolerances of the building of that door. So if you're at 845, technically you may not need it. So you're going to want to really pay attention to that and make sure that those doors that you're buying can meet this 850 millimeter clear opening with that door open. Initially, there was some language that said open to 90 degrees. Most of these doors won't hit 850 at 90 degrees. They need to be about 100 or 110. So anyway, a lot of discussion about that. They did remove that 90 degrees and just leave it at open, so that it gave you that flexibility. Anyway, that's a good one to look at too, so that, you know, you're going to be looking at least one entry having to meet this clear opening requirement. So that's 1883. That's a good one to read. They also were looking for, there was a lot of early discussions about having low profile door sills. And the industry has really struggled with that and pushed back on that. A 13 millimeter height door sill is extremely challenging to meet the other requirements for doors, air, water, structural. So for the moment, it looks like that's getting a bit of a pass, but the clear opening is definitely going to be one that we're going to be having to deal with.
That's something else. I thought we'd see ground level sills by now, but yeah. Okay. Yep.
No. Another one that I was on, just as we're talking about low profile door sills, was on the use and egress side and the accessibility. And what they were discussing was having a balcony be accessible. So they were pushing for a 13 millimeter door sill on a door to a balcony, which, okay, I kind of understand you're pushing for accessibility. But when I raised the point that, as per the building code, a balcony acts as a roof, and at a penetration of a roof, you need 150 millimeter upstand. So when you see a balcony in a building, there's actually a 6-inch, 150 millimeter upturn before the penetration. Well, what's the point of putting in a 13 millimeter door sill if you have a 6-inch drop to the balcony? So that's been shelved for now. There's discussions going on about how to deal with that. So we won't see that at balconies in this code cycle.
Good.
Interesting.
Sorry, anything else on the accessibility point, Terry?
2028 code change 2028 expands the scope of accessibility requirements. And that's just a good one just to read to understand all of these accessibility potential changes that are coming. And 2028 digs into all of those different things. So that's a good one to read.
Yeah. The famous example being BC banning doorknobs a while back there.
City of Vancouver.
City of Vancouver. Sorry. Yeah.
Right. actually, that's a great one. And I'm kind of glad you raised that, because I had a member inquiry yesterday, because they are in Vancouver dealing with a project, and they have lever handles, which is fine. But also in the requirement for those handles, the handle has to be operable with no more load than 38 newtons to operate it, which is about 8.5 pounds for people like me that are still in Imperial.
Yeah.
So the challenge for the manufacturer is, well, how do I test that? There's no reference to the test standard. So anyway, we're working our way through it, but anybody out there that is certainly in the city of Vancouver, because they're talking about this. I know in BC also has that in their code. There is a requirement for a specific load to operate that handle. How do you test it? There is no standard to test it. So we're going to dive into that and see if we can get some clarity. But
like, that's not anything that the hardware guys label for. I think some of the, well, I know some commercial products have operating right. listings, but I don't think on any residential product, maybe a high end one, yeah. right? You're not always
certainly nothing. That. I mean, there's certainly nothing in NAFS. I mean, NAFS talks about force to latch, but that's different. That's about pulling the door closed to latch. So, you know, how do you test this? Do you hang a rock on the door handle? And, you know, like, there's no standard criteria for a pass fail. And anyway, we're going to have to work our way through it. It's a challenge. But again, you know, devil's in the details when you start diving into what the code says. So,
yeah, because if there's no standard, standard and there's no documentation, it's a matter of having an engineer sign off on it. So what are you going to do? Have an engineer sign off on every door you put in?
The engineer is going to want the manufacturer to apply some kind of test to this thing. So it's a problem.
That's going to be difficult. So, probably not enforced much if it gets in.
The changes in accessibility are going to be difficult. There's no doubt about it.
Yeah. On the manufacturer side, are people listening to this liable to run into doors that don't hit the right size there, Terry? As far as the clear width, are the manufacturers going to move away from that in reaction?
I think that you're going to have people that put doors in that don't get there. Absolutely. Yeah. You know, I saw, I can't remember, and, you know, I'm not obviously not going to mention, but I saw a 3 foot door that was actually a 35 3/8 slab. That would not make it, even though it's a 3 foot door.
No way.
Yeah. So you're going to have to be aware of what that opening is and make sure you're putting in the right door.
Okay. Got to keep moving. We'll skip the mass number thing. Let's get into energy. The energy codes. What are the changes? Terry, you mentioned airtightness. There's some changes to how we have to do that.
A little bit beyond fenestration, even though fenestration can have a significant impact.
Yeah.
But code change 1819 looks at changes to how the air tightness is calculated for the overall building. Again, not a direct impact per se on fenestration, but as buildings tighten up, you know, builders are going to need to be aware that, you know, different products have different air leakage rates and amounts. And again, you know, I don't want to point to specific products that may or may not perform better, but the reality is that products that slide and products that close like a door, like a compression seal, often have, you know, quite significantly different air leakage rates. So if you're putting in, you know, two or three large sliding door systems, those could have an impact on, you know, on what your air leakage overall could be. And how they calculate this, you know, may impact that, because obviously the intent is to tighten up buildings. So I'm sure that these changes in the calculations will do exactly that. So moving forward, air tightness is obviously, it's a big deal in energy efficiency. So it should be, you know, be aware of products and their air tightness, because they're going to impact whether or not you can pass some of these air leakage tests.
Is it a significant change to the to the amount of tightness they want, Terry, or is it just a tweak?
I have to admit, I don't know the exact calculations because that's not what I do every day. But we do see that as you move through these energy performance changes, as we head to 2030, you know, you go from 3.5 per hour to 2.5 to 1.5 to 1 to 0.5 by 2030, 0.5 air changes per hour. I mean, when you get down to 0.5, that is a really tight building.
That's low. So,
yeah, that's really low. Obviously, those are, you know, kind of passive house, obviously net zero homes, you're talking 0.5 air changes per hour. That's really tight. And to hit those numbers with, you know, large leaky products will be challenging for guys. So something to be aware of as air tightness gets ramped down.
That leads us into the tier system that is been out there for a while now, but is, I think, still something a lot of people are wrapping their heads around. Quick recap on the tier 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 energy performances and what changes, if any, they're looking at there.
Right. So 1830, the tiered code that's in the National Building Code is all about ramping up performance by levels as we move through the next 6 years or so to 2030. So right now they have requirements up to tier 2. Now they are talking about what these values are going to be for 3, 4, and 5. So code change 1830 is proposed changes for compliance with tier 5 energy requirements. And of most interest there is going to be table 936.94 that provides proposed values for tier 5 prescriptive performance. So, and this is always something that's, you know, trying to wrap your head around prescriptive and performance pathways. So they need to keep, and I expect certainly for this, well, certainly the 2025 cycle, there will be prescriptive performance paths that say, if you need to meet tier 3, here's the products that you need to have. Here's the performance that you need to have. It's relatively quote unquote simple, as opposed to getting into performance, which is a whole other ball game where you get into building modeling and performance modeling. They need to keep the prescriptive path in certainly for now, because there are regions that are challenged by following a performance path. Because performance path, now you get into energy modelers, energy advisors, air blower door testing, things like that, that, you know, regions in the north or in more remote regions can't find people to do this, or it's cost prohibitive. So they're going to keep these prescriptive tiers in, certainly through 2025. And, you know, I mean, I'll get the crystal ball out, probably through 2030, but I think by 2030, the tiered path will be so restrictive that people will find ways to get to the performance path. Because the performance path, generally speaking, is an easier path to follow, because you can trade things. You can put in better windows or more insulation, et cetera, et cetera. So it gives a builder a lot more flexibility. We saw that in British Columbia. BC uses a step code, which is a bit different than the tiered code. And what we actually saw for fenestration when they started to push into step code 3 was that triple glazed windows were very beneficial in the overall build from a cost return on investment as other options to get to those targets. So it just gives a builder a lot more flexibility when you are able to work through the performance path. So anyway, 1830 talks about the tier 5 energy requirements and gives you some indication of where those numbers are going to be, and provides the opportunity to comment. So it's a good one to look at. It's aggressive. I mean, we're talking about, you know, by 2030 at you know, window products at under 1.0 U value. So really aggressive numbers, right? So.
Yeah. No, and there's been so much conversation in the window manufacturing industry about that. I mean, that's just it's unbelievable how tight they came in on that stuff. By the way, the numbers that Terry is throwing out here, I believe, are the numbers that indicate the change request in the NBC document.
Right.
So when you're saying 1830 and all this stuff, that's in the comment,
right?
Like where you go to comment.
Exactly.
Okay.
So 1830 is a code change request, a CCR.
Right.
And it will list that number as being that change request, and then it'll give you the title that is very descriptive, so you'll see what it's all about, and then you can go in there and have a look at that. Talking about tiers and energy conservation, code change 1890 is energy conservation points for tiers 3, 4, and 5. And I really wrestled with this when I was first starting to dive into the tiered energy path. So you have compliance energy requirements by tier, and then you have energy conservation points by tiers. And that can get a bit confusing about which one you're talking about. So points is about, you're in this climatic zone and you need this many points to get to compliance. So for, let's say, a triple glazed window at X U value could get you 4 points and you need 10. And I'm just throwing out just random numbers to give you an idea of how that works. So in 1890, code change 1890, they are going to lay out the points for tiers 3, 4, and 5. So because we only had tiers 1 and 2, which was, I think there were 5 and 10 points, but don't quote me on that. So within this code change information, 1890, there are also several tables that lay out different option paths that include a really broad range of projected costs for these paths. Exactly where they got those costs, you know, I don't know. I mean, I know that for the entry doors, they looked at Home Depot. So, you know, how they came up with these costs, you know, I mean, take it for what it is. But what it does show is that, you know, a really, really high performance window and its cost may show you that it's a much better, and again, I go back to this step code 3 in BC, it's a much better option than putting in R80 in your roof, for example. And I don't know that that's true, but it lays out all of these different optional pathways with projected costs by climatic zone. It's great information. It's a lot of content, but what you can do is you can go to sort of your region, your climatic zone, and you can start having a look at, oh, okay, well, hey, windows will be better. Windows might not be as good if it's, you know, a poorer performer, let's say a dual glaze, one low E. You know, it's great content. So I really recommend builders look at 1890 and get an understanding of what the cost implications of what these performance goals mean to them. It's great content, really good.
That point system is like LEED, right?
Yeah, I guess.
Same concept,
you could,
right?
Say it's very similar. And, yeah. And you know, if you understand it, and it can be challenging, I'll admit, you know, there's a lot of things you can do to make your build more efficient without breaking the bank and without getting into things that are really complicated. So, it's a good thing as a builder to have an understanding of the paths that are open to you to get to these targets.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Okay.
The guys over at Building Knowledge are really great with this. And I know that Ontario, a lot of builders in Ontario work with the folks there, and they've got a great handle on this stuff. Props to them, because they're good. They're great supporters of high performance fenestration, which is always a good thing to hear. So
they are, and I believe they've even had you talk at their conferences.
I've participated with some stuff with them.
You've done some stuff with them, Gordon, Andy.
Great guys.
Shout out to you guys. They know everything energy for sure, and everything absolutely. Building science, to be honest.
They're doing good work.
Yeah, they're doing good work. Here's one right on the window side of things. Solar heat gain, Terry. What are we talking about there? What's new there?
Yeah, if you want to see a good championship boxing match, put a ring in the center of the country and invite all the guys across the country to talk about solar heat gain, because the conversation varies by where you are in the country, and it varies significantly. So solar heat gain, we all know that there's an impact. It can be a benefit and it can be a negative to your build. Certainly when it comes to, homeowner comfort, things like that, performance. So there was a proposal in code change 1823 in the first round of public review that laid down solar heat gain limits. If I'm not mistaken, I think there was three numbers based on window to wall ratios that were applicable across the country. So for example, if you had a window to wall ratio, I think the number was more than 22%, something like that. It gave you a solar heat gain limit of X, and that applied from Victoria to St. John's, which everybody, it doesn't make any sense. It doesn't make any sense. And, I voiced my concern at the Energy Efficiency Steering Committee prior to this, that I was concerned that one number equates to a one value Energy Star number, which I won't get into that in this conversation. But again, it's a big country with a wide range of climatic conditions. So anyway, unfortunately, the activity of that group that's looking at solar heat gain was not able to make this round of public review. But that may be a good thing, because in the last round, the folks at AVFQ put together a great report on solar heat gain, as well as proposed tables based on heating degree days and window to wall ratios, which is the absolute correct way to look at solar heat gain impacts for fenestration and buildings. So a great proposal, great work, props to those guys, really, really excellent work. I had a couple of comments and tweaks to it that I think that would help the final goal. Anyway, point being is that was raised during the last public review. The groups looking at that are taking all of it under consideration. And I think that they see and accept that the initial proposal was probably not the best way to go. In the next round of public review, I'm hoping beyond hope that we will see amendments based on the proposal that ABFQ put together, hopefully with a few tweaks that might help the cause. But ultimately, we know that solar heat gain can be a challenge in some regions of the country when it comes to overheating of buildings. We certainly see it in the West, where you see buildings that are very efficient using high solar gain products that are running air conditioners almost all year long. It can be a problem. And the challenge with solar heat gain and high solar heat gain is being exacerbated by very efficient buildings that we're starting to build and that we're seeing built over the last, decade or so. So that in the old days, quote unquote, a home would capture all of this solar heat gain, maybe through clear glass, but it was such a poorly insulated and airtight building that heat would dissipate overnight. And then you'd start the process again the next day. But now these buildings are so efficient that they heat up and then the heat can't get out. And over a period of time, if you have, summertime or even shoulder seasons in some regions where buildings heat up because of high solar heat gain and larger window to wall ratios, that heat does not escape. And it just becomes, after a few days, it's unbearable in your home, right? So anyway, we certainly hope to see in the next public review new proposal for solar heat gain limits. And I certainly expect that that will get pushed through and that we will see 2025 NBC limits on solar heat gain. I certainly hope so, because I think that it's the right move.
Well, it's so overdue. I mean, we've been hearing for, back when the ENERGY STAR standards were developed in the 70s and everything else. I mean, the only thing anybody ever thought about in Canada, I never had air conditioning in a house that I lived in until the 90s. All anybody ever thought about was the heating load as far as energy use. And nowadays, I believe a lot of building people will tell you that the air conditioning is by far a greater energy suck on Canadian buildings. If you're in the Yukon, but
there is absolutely a place for solar heat gain.
Yeah,
absolutely. And I've always been a proponent that, it has its place.
Yeah.
But to apply one number across the country makes no sense. And I'll give you an example. In my former life, we supplied a lot of homes, high-end homes, in West Vancouver, southwest facing, huge glazing facades, using medium solar gain products, and the people could barely live in some of the rooms.
Yeah,
because it got so incredibly hot, and these are high-end homes with air conditioning.
Yeah,
so it needs to be managed.
Yeah,
and we're just seeing that. And again, it's all about building more efficient homes, just exacerbates the problem. So we need to get a handle on it. Absolutely.
Talk a little bit, Terry, about the 26 degree restriction in Vancouver. Because as we're saying in my framing of it, this is Canada's first ever cooling requirement in a house, and it touches this solar heat gain. You have to have your strategies to arrive at this. But talk a little bit about that, Terry, and maybe how it's different than people think.
Yeah, absolutely. So BC, everybody knows about the heat dome we had here a few years ago, where extreme temperatures for about a week in southwest BC, many, many people died as a result. So BC has been really proactive about addressing the potential for overheating in homes. And what they did under the 2024 BC Building Code that's based on the 2020 NBC is that that just recently was adopted at the beginning of March here. They have a requirement that one room in the home needs to maintain a 26 degrees Celsius room temperature as a safe room, cool room, whatever you want to call it. I got caught up in this discussion early days, and certainly at the national level, because I think that there's people that don't understand what this actually means. So everybody, no, that's not fair. A lot of people thought, well, there's no way you're going to be able to keep a room at 26 degrees when you're having extreme events and it's 40 degrees outside, et cetera, et cetera. That is not at all what this code change says. The code change actually says, I should have had the language in front of me, but I don't, forgive me. It says you need to maintain 26 degrees in one room at July temperatures. I can't remember the term, but July mean temperature or average temperature, whatever it is. I can't remember the exact term. And it refers to table C2 in the building code. So what I did is I grabbed Abbotsford, BC, which is my old hometown where I grew up as a kid. The July temperature in Abbotsford is 29 degrees. So that means that you need to maintain 26 degrees in one room when it's 29 degrees outside. The sky is not falling.
Yeah.
You know, it is obviously something that people, builders, will need to address. You're going to need to have a room that can do that, which means, you know, some form of cooling, but it's not, you know, 26 degrees when it's 42 degrees outside. Now, you know, maybe Lytton, for example, which experienced the fire, you know, they were like 49 degrees, 50 degrees. During that week, they were actually hotter than Death Valley. We had the hottest temperature in all of North America that week in Lytton. Anyway, I didn't check Lytton's temperature. I should have. I should have looked at their July temperature because it does get hot, really hot. So yeah, in areas like that, it may be more challenging and you might have to have more robust cooling, but you know what? You probably should. But again, the reality is this is not a 26 degree for every condition, for every home, for every location. It is all about managing reasonable July temperatures for your region, which, you know what, it's a good thing. I think that it's a wise move. And guys are going to find different ways to do it. You might be able to do it if the house has an in-ground basement on the north side with some passive cooling measures. Like, there's ways that could achieve that, I'm sure. So, but it's coming.
100%.
Yeah, it's definitely coming. I don't know if it'll make the 2025. I think so. There's a lot of activity and a lot of discussion to try and get that done. So I do expect that it's coming in this next cycle.
Yeah, I mean, even looking at it before, I mean, my thought was, you know, most houses are large enough that you've got a room somewhere in there, or like you say, a basement that's unlikely to get hotter than that. The only thing that entered my mind, which again isn't so much for our residential audience here, is you know, if you had a high rise apartment that was all you know, it wasn't very deep and there was all windows along the one side, and those weren't you know, low solar heat gain windows, that's where you could potentially have somewhere you couldn't escape from.
Yeah. Sure, row houses and townhouses. Southern exposures or western exposures with a lot of glass, because oftentimes those floor spaces are open, right? Yeah. So you know, other than bedrooms, which are usually upper floors. So yeah, it could be challenging in some building designs for sure.
My mother's old place, row house, big kitchen windows on one side, big backyard windows on the other side. So, and it was basically open concept. It was in continuous room from one to the other. Windows obviously on all the bedrooms upstairs, and then a walkout basement with a sliding glass door, which you know how the heat comes into those puppies.
Yeah, for sure.
That's a condition where maybe you get no escape. So
for sure.
It's interesting stuff, and it, you know, but could a situation like that be mitigated with various fenestration products that'll control solar heat gain. Something our builders need to be looking at and thinking about,
you know, there's, in the future. You know, there's a wide range of products out there that manage solar gain.
Yeah.
And they're increasing. Like we're seeing, more and more options for dealing with solar gain. The glass guys, they know it. They're addressing it, so that you know that there's options for guys to manage this.
Yeah, it is. It is out there. Okay, moving right along. Fall protection. This is a neat one. Oh my God, did people ever tear their hair out in the window manufacturing industry for many years trying to figure out how to simultaneously let the person be able to get out of the window, but not be able to have the toddler open the window on the upper stories, Terry?
And the hardware manufacturers have done a spectacular job at developing devices that can do that. Yep. Now, the problem is that some people were not receptive to those solutions. Mm. Now, the change that happened in the 2020, which is what we're adopting right now, that activity went on years ago. Whether I could have changed anything, who knows, but it's irrelevant now. So the change that came into 2020 was that, a window that is less than an opening that is less than 900 millimeters from the floor and 1800 millimeters to the ground requires fall protection. So the difficulty is, like you say, if you have an egress bedroom window that falls into that requirement, how do you deal with it? Because mm-hmm. you need to protect it from somebody falling out mm-hmm. and you need to be able to open it. Well, my friends, other than Quebec, there is no solution. The WOCD device that is available and compliant in the US and in Quebec will do exactly that. It will lock with a restrictor to prevent fall protection, and it will be openable to allow egress. The difficulty is in the language about how that device opens. Fall protection requires a device that is openable, that cannot be opened without the use of tools or special knowledge. So essentially unscrewing it or a key or something like that. A WOCD F2090, that's the standard device, is openable without the use of special tools or knowledge. It's a conflict in that language. Now, when we saw this in the public reviews during the NBC's public reviews for 2020, Fenestration Canada, along with WDMA and FGIA, jumped on it right away. We did outreach to the provinces because it was in the 2020 code. There was nothing we could do at that point. We did some outreach to the provinces explaining that we thought that this was a mistake and that the F2090 device is a better solution. And the logic is, in our opinion, is that devices that are not releasable are often removed by the homeowner because they want to open their window. You see it all the time. 3-4-story apartments, windows wide open. It's because people have removed them because they're a pain. You can't open your window. Mm-hmm. So again, we did some outreach. Unfortunately, the majority of the provinces see this as a safety issue. Of course it is. And that to go against what the 2020 NBC has done is very challenging because it's such a safety issue. It involves children. Everybody knows that that's obviously a huge concern. And they didn't want to play with it, right? Because if, heaven forbid, they made the change and accepted these devices, and a child opened it and fell out and was hurt or killed. Of
right.
course, nobody wants that, of course. So right now, under the 2020 NBC, these devices are not compliant for fall protection. That's the long and short of it. If you have a window in a bedroom that requires egress and it is under 900 millimeters and 1800 millimeters to the ground outside, you do not have a compliant solution. You need to move the window or, you know, alternative solution. You could apply to the local jurisdiction saying, look, I want to use these devices, but it's highly unlikely a local jurisdiction is also going to go against a safety item in the building code, but it's certainly, you know, it's certainly an option that you can try. Now, Alberta was very receptive. The Building Safety Council in Alberta was also very receptive and understood our logic. So I know that Alberta has a proposed amendment in draft, and we're just waiting to see where that goes. If the government of Alberta decides to accept this code, they call it a stand data, so it's an amendment to the Alberta code. If they choose to accept it, then we could see these devices being an option. But today, that is not the case. And I know that there were people in Alberta that, because the draft was put out and submitted, they thought that it was in play. It's not yet. So, you know, it's unfortunate that this is where we're at, because again, restrictors get removed. I know it. I see it. It happens all the time. And now you have zero protection for falls. So, you know, we're on it. We know it's a challenge. We know it's an issue. And we're, you know, I have a code change request in for the 2025 cycle that we're in right now. Now, the problem with that is that there's over 2,000 code change requests in the queue for the 2020-2025 code cycle. You know, whether we'll even get a sniff at it, you know, I don't know. I highly doubt it at this point, because, you know, they're already dealing with more than they can deal with today. So, you know, we're going to continue to push it. We're going to continue to lobby the provinces to look at this as a better option. And you know, that's our position. We believe that it's a better option, but, you know, you need to be really cautious about what you're doing for fall protection, as well as an egress condition and how you're going to deal with that. So builders need to be aware that this is a problem. And, you know, I'm working on a one pager that we're going to put out that kind of, you know, really gives me a very simple sort of view of what this means. I hope to have that done very, very soon, and we'll get it out so that there's some clarity. But yeah, it's a frustrating one for sure.
There's so much that could be said about it. The engineering on some of the devices is actually pretty cool.
They're very slick devices.
Yeah, you know, and there are things that I think couldn't be easily removed, or you wouldn't even want to, because the release is actually not that difficult. Yeah. But anyways, Terry, your time.
Yeah.
I got to watch it here. And we need to hit guard load glazing. Our buddy Dave Goldsmith's favorite topic.
guard glazing. So there was some changes there as well in the 2020 that are now in play for anybody that's adopted that, and most regions are either adopted or soon, sometime this year. So guard load glazing, 900 millimeters from the floor, 600 millimeters to the outside from the floor level, right? So that gets a bit confusing, right? So this is a really, really challenging one to wrap your head around, because if you look at the guard clauses, it talks about there needs to be a guard at stairs, ramps, landings, and then it says mezzanines, walkways, raised galleries. But then below, it also says in dwelling units, guards are required at ramps, stairs, one other one. I can't think of it. Anyway, so I'm like, well, where does this apply? It's ramps, landing, ramps, landings, and stairs.
Ramps, landings, and stairs. Yep.
So my question was, is guard glazing in a dwelling unit, part nine home dwelling unit, required at ramps, landings, and stairs? Or is it required at ramps, landings, stairs, mezzanines, galleries, raised walkways, which essentially means everywhere?
Yeah.
So I've posed that now to the folks here in BC, because they've adopted the 2020 in their published 2024. I just got an answer yesterday, excuse me. And I'm reading their response as saying everywhere. So, and that's been what's happening certainly in the West. And I've also heard in some other regions where building officials are now looking at guard glazing anywhere in a single family home that would meet that criteria, 900 millimeters, 600 millimeters to the ground from the floor, right?
Okay.
So that
and that requires what for the glazing?
That requires safety glass.
Right.
But it's not just safety glass. Most building officials now are asking for an engineer's approval of that glass, that it meets the impact loads for guards, which means designing. You can't just throw in tempered safety glass and say, oh, I'm good, and expect that you're okay. Guys need to understand this. You should talk to your engineer. There are simplified ways to get there. There's a tool that allows a manufacturer to design this glass. That's what I did in my former life. We had the software, ran the numbers, used the correct glass. If we were ever challenged, our engineer would look at the report that we generated, confirm our production documents, and give us a letter. So there's ways to do it. Guys need to understand that that's what's happening. I'm also working on getting clarification that that's the case across the country. I think it probably is, but I'm working on getting that clarified, that guard load glazing anywhere in a single family home that would fall under the criteria of where it's required, 900 millimeters from the floor, 600 millimeters to the ground outside from the floor level.
Yeah.
So,
it is not a one size fits all solution, because depending on the length of your stairs, depending on the space that people have to move coming up to the guard, depending on the height of things, it's like I don't know how building inspectors address it, frankly. That's the point. The building inspector can't address it, so they're going to look at it and go, well, I'm worried about somebody running through this window at the bottom of your staircase. And you're going to say, well, no, it's okay. It meets the thing. And they're going to go, well, I need an engineer. I have to,
exactly.
I don't know if this frame will hold the glass in if somebody hits this thing. I don't know what's around it. So, these are changes that are coming.
Yeah. There's going to be a lot of scrutiny on that item as we move forward. In the West, already happening. I see it all the time. And certainly I've had calls from members in Ontario that are being faced with this, that are asking, well, what do I need to be doing here? Right. So yeah, it's out there. Definitely happening.
Terry, mindful of your time. We got to go. But so much great information there. That was an information density download. folks, this has been Terry Adamson. He is the technical director for Fenestration Canada. Totally encourage you to reach out to him and the association, fenestrationcanada.ca, if you have any questions about windows and doors. And I think the message here today is we're just trying to give you some pointers, at least when it comes to the fenestration aspects of the building. Go and look at the public review for the NBC. As we always like to say, if you don't say anything, you can't complain later.
Exactly. There you go. Good luck. Yeah.
Dive in with your comments and use Terry's comments here as a guide. Terry, thank you very much for joining us today on The Hammer.
Patrick, thank you very much. It's been my pleasure. Check on another career activity that I've worked on The Hammer.
Thanks so much, Terry. Have a
good
one. You bet.
Thank you. All right. Thanks.
This episode of The Hammer is brought to you by All Weather Windows. All-Weather Windows is Canada's leading manufacturer of high-performance, energy-efficient windows, doors, and glass. With their expert market knowledge, All-Weather Windows offers a complete range of products tailored to suit your specific regional needs, ensuring each one meets or exceeds the latest local and national building codes and stringent energy efficiency standards. Not only that, All-Weather Windows' entire product catalog is NAFS and NFRC certified, promising unmatched value and comfort for your customers. Let All-Weather Windows be your first choice for all your door and window needs. Visit their website, allweatherwindows.com, to learn more.
Thanks for listening to The Hammer. You can find episodes online at CanadianContractor.com or subscribe on your favorite podcasting service. The Hammer is presented by Canadian Contractor Magazine.